As tight end on the Grinnell College football team, Edward Hirsch caught the second highest number of passes in the history of the team. But often, when it was time for football practice, the coach would have to drag Hirsch away from reading his poetry to his English teacher. Edward Hirsch today teaches creative writing at the University of Houston and is one of the most highly acclaimed poets of his generation. He's also the star of the faculty staff basketball team at the university. Poet Robert Penn Warren said of Hirsch's book, Wild Gratitude, "I am convinced that the best poems here are unsurpassed in our time." The National Book Critics Circle agreed and named Wild Gratitude the winner of their poetry award for 1986. This past spring, Hirsch was also awarded the Prix de Rome. Hirsch's first book of poetry is titled For the Sleepwalkers. A frequent theme in his work is the nighttime and insomnia. I asked him if he's an insomniac.
I'm afraid I am. But, you know, I began as a, you know, sleeplessly, and I used to do a lot of writing at night. I don't as much as I used to. Now I read a lot at night. But I think that one of the reasons I've written about it so much is not just that I'm an insomniac. I'm lots of other things, too, and I don't write about all of those, but that something about insomnia has given me lots of possibilities as a writer. I guess I like the dramatic situation of one person feeling that he or she is awake all on his own.
While everyone else
seems to be sleeping. And there's a sort of drama in that. It's also a way of writing about consciousness and unconsciousness. And that's striking to me. And so I guess I've sort of mined the metaphoric possibilities. When I first started writing, of course, I was just writing because I was awake. But as I thought about it and wrote about it more, that became one of my subjects.
Well, I think there's also a dread to insomnia. I mean, for people, that you can begin to fear the night.
Well, it's, you know, there's a dread and there's an anxiety and there's also a mysterious quality to it. And I guess writing about darkness and night seem more my subject than writing about day. Although one writes about the day after the night and coming out through it. But it's a lot about consciousness and a way to isolate consciousness and write about sort of the mind at work when others seem to be sleeping.
Well, I think it's funny at night when you can't sleep that somehow the boundaries that we live with during the day disappear in a sense, and you can almost feel a sense of being insane.
Well, that's its, you know, that's its worst edge, I guess. Yeah. On its more positive side, you know, a French theorist like Bachelard says that daydreaming is necessary to poetry. Well, a certain kind of wakeful night dreaming is too. And there is a way where, as you say, the boundaries of consciousness are loosened a little bit. But that doesn't have to just lead to madness. It can also lead to creativity.
Well, I think you have sort of turned that around.
Well, it's, you know, one of the things we do as writers is take the dark and dreck and try and turn them into the radiant and the beautiful. Take one of our, you know, our darkest and innermost fears and try and transform them. And one of the things about making poems is that you try and find a way to do that and to turn it into something beautiful and to turn what is potentially negative into something wonderfully positive.
Why don't you read us one of your poems about sleeplessness?
That would be my pleasure. I always think this poem is a bit funny, but other people tend to feel sorry for me. So this is it. It's called I Need Help. For all the insomniacs in the world, I want to build a new kind of machine for flying out of the body at night. This will win peace prizes, I know it, but I can't do it myself. I'm exhausted. I need help from the inventors. I admit I'm desperate. I know that the legs in my legs are trembling and the skeleton wants out of my body because the night of the rock has fallen. I want someone to lower a huge pulley and hoist it back over the mountain because I can't do it alone. It's so dark out here that I'm staggering down the street like a drunk or a cripple. I'm almost a hunchback from trying to hold up the sky by myself. The clouds are enormous, and I need strength from the weightlifters. How many nights can I go on like this without a single light from the sky? No moon, no stars, not even one dingy street lamp. I want to hold a rummage sale for the clouds and send up flashlights, matchbooks, kerosene, and old lanterns. I need bright, fiery donations. And how many nights can I go on walking through the garden like a ghost, listening to flowers gasping in the dirt, small mouths gulping for air like tiny black asthmatics, fighting their bodies, eating the wind. I need the green thumbs of a gardener. And I need help from the judges. Tonight I want to court-martial the dark faces that flare up under the heavy grasses. So many blank moons. So many dead mouths holding their breath in the shallow ground, almost breathing. I have no idea why my own face is never among them. But I want to stop blaming myself for this. I want to hear the hard gavel in my chest pounding the verdict, not guilty as charged. But I can't do this alone. I need help from the serious men in black robes. And because I can't lift the enormous weight of this enormous night from my shoulders, I need help from the six pallbearers of sleep who rise out of the slow, vacant shadows to hoist the body into an empty coffin. I need their help to fly out of myself.
That's Edward Hirsch reading from his book of poetry called Wild Gratitude. That's I Need Help, and Wild Gratitude is published by Knopf, and Edward Hirsch teaches creative writing at the University of Houston and was the 1986 winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for Poetry. When I was reading about you, I saw there a photograph of you sent, and underneath the photograph it said, Poet Athlete Ed Hirsch. And it was a very...
Was my father sending you photographs again?
Well, I was wondering, are you a poet athlete?
I'm not as much as as I used to be. But when I first started to write poetry seriously when I was in college, and I was playing football at the time. I went to a small school in Iowa called Grinnell College. And eventually I became an academic All-American in football. And so this is how this got started, because it was a small college and it wasn't that serious at football, but nonetheless I played, and I cared about it quite a lot, and of course I was also becoming a poet at the same time. And so I guess it seemed like such an unusual combination to so many people that when I was in college quite a lot of fuss was made out of this. People have such stereotypes about being a poet that every now and then you have to remind them that you can be a jock, too.
Well, I think there are also stereotypes about being an athlete, which is that you can't be articulate. And yeah. I think for poets, we tend to think of people as rather ascetic.
I guess that's the other side, yeah.
You're neither. I mean, you're...
Yeah, poets can live in the world, too.
That's right.
Like most poets I know, for example, are serious basketball fans. Doesn't quite go with the stereotype of the aesthete of a poet. I've done a good job of breaking that one down.
Well, you play basketball, isn't that right?
I play basketball, yeah, and I play in a serious amateur game at the University of Houston. But it's just quite the right game for me, because we play at lunchtime, and it's faculty and staff, and everyone goes back to work in the afternoon, so I'm not so interested in playing with 18-year-old kids who can dunk backwards anymore. But nonetheless, we play intensely, so... It is my game, and it must have been, there were a couple of articles at in the Houston papers about this. And
yes.
Of course, I impressed my fellow faculty members at my basketball game by having a photographer follow me up and down the court one day. New glory.
For this poet, athlete.
For this poet. I published a whole book of poems called For the Sleepwalkers, which was my first book, and I didn't write a thing about sports.
Yeah.
And in fact, when I started writing poetry, because sports had been so much of my life, it was probably the last thing that I wanted to write about. I had no interest in it. I was really interested. I was much more interested in writing about Matisse and Paul Klee and things like that, and urban experiences, and getting some people into poems who I hadn't found in poems before, but not sports. And it wasn't until after I'd published For the Sleepwalkers that it began, I'd kind of discovered an idiom and a style, and it occurred to me that that idiom was a bit of a straitjacket if I couldn't write about sports.
Yeah.
And I began to feel that maybe I ought to be able to write about sports just because you keep expanding the notion of the lyrics so that it should be able to include anything. And I began with that general idea, and then I had a specific occasion. And that's that when I was teaching at Wayne State University, my closest friend, a man named Dennis Turner, who I used to play pickup basketball with all the time, died of cancer. And I wanted to write a poem that was an elegy for Dennis, and I wanted to write about something we shared, and so I wrote a poem about basketball. So,
why don't you read it for us?
Thanks. This is called Fast Break, in memory of Dennis Turner, 1946 to 1984. A hookshot kisses the rim and hangs there helplessly, but doesn't drop. And for once our gangly starting center boxes out his man and times his jump perfectly, gathering the orange leather from the air like a cherished possession and spinning around to throw a strike to the outlet, who is already shoveling an underhand pass toward the other guard, scissoring past a flat-footed defender who looks stunned and nailed to the floor in the wrong direction, trying to catch sight of a high gliding dribble, and a man letting the play develop in front of him in slow motion, almost exactly like a coach's drawing on the blackboard, both forwards racing down the court the way that forwards should, fanning out and filling the lanes in tandem, moving together as brothers, passing the ball between them without a dribble, without a single bounce hitting the hardwood, until the guard finally lunges out and commits to the wrong man, while the power forward explodes past them in a fury, taking the ball into the air by himself now, and laying it gently against the glass for a layup, but losing his balance in the process, inexplicably falling, hitting the floor with a wild, headlong motion for the game he loved like a country, and swiveling back to see an orange blur floating perfectly through the net.
That's a lovely, lyrical, beautiful poem.
Thanks. I mean, I began with this general idea that I wanted to write something about Dennis and that I wanted to write something about basketball. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I started writing a lot about basketball and coming up with memories and writing about gyms. And then it suddenly became an interesting thing to me formally to see if I could write a poem that would follow a single play. And then I began to write about a fast break. And then I thought, well, what would happen if you read the whole poem a single sentence, as that one is? So you'd get that sort of headlong quality that you get as in a fast break. Then I forgot about my friend Dennis, and I was just writing about basketball, and I was really interested in the form of the poem and following it through and making the whole poem kick off and follow in the minutest detail a fast break. Then I sent my guy up for a shot, and I suddenly realized in writing it that I was also writing an elegy, that the man going up by himself was isolated in the way that my friend had been isolated, and that suddenly the fast break became a metaphor for something else. And I became really excited because I felt I had a poem about basketball that was also a poem that was elegiac, and that I had discovered something in the process.
Well, I think there are those moments when in sports where time stops, or there's just an incredible quality of whether you're with a team and there's this kind of flow and movement and beauty to what's going on, or there's that moment when you hit the ball and it feels like perfection.
Well, you know, if you read, sometimes people, when you read about sports or talk about it, I mean, the way you've just talked about sports a bit in those moments of perfection are the way lots of lyric poets talk about poems. And it occurred to me that some people talk about plays, single plays, you know, single inspired moments out of time, much the way I'd heard people, poets, talk about poems that really work. And, of course, you know, poets and critics go off to then sort of invent a new critical language, and sports writers tend to turn, you know, moments of sport into terrible cliches.
Yes.
But there are these overlaps of moments, sort of radiant moments that seem extraordinarily graceful and beautiful and articulate and singular. I wanted to capture one of those in my poem, and that the form of the poem would also try and capture it.
My guest is poet Edward Hirsch. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Edward Hirsch. He teaches creative writing at the University of Houston. He has two books of poetry. One is For the Sleepwalkers. The other is Wild Gratitude. Both are published by Knopf. And he's the 1986 winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for poetry. I understand that you write in public places, even places like Dunkin' Donuts,
now,
dare I say.
Now, who's gone and told you that? I do.
But you do that consciously. I mean,
yeah,
you don't kind of... set yourself off in a quiet, darkened room?
No, I don't. I think that it's partially that, you know, when you're a writer, you spend so much time by yourself. It's such a certain kind of isolated activity, although finally it's social because you're using language and you are ultimately trying to find readers. But it's such an isolated activity in the making of it. And you spend so much time alone that I get a bit lonely.
Yes.
And that when day comes, I like to go out like other people too. And so I've, you know, found cafeterias and donut shops and places like that to be quite useful for me. And sometimes people find it amusing because, you know, there I am, hunched over my papers, talking to myself. And every now and then, you know, the bag ladies and I get on the same little routine of going from place to place.
Yeah. Are those some of the unsung people that
And those
that
are
you
some of those
want?
Are, you know, Whitman says stand up for the stupid and crazy. And I'm interested in that. That's the beginning of a politics. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in writing about those people. And you certainly see them when you hang out in donut shops. But I really started doing that just because I liked a certain sort of buzz and activity around me. Now, if there's music or if you know the people, it doesn't work at all. But and it's not that I don't work at home, too. But I do like to go out and sort of drink bad coffee and, you know, sit in those uncomfortable chairs and do my work.
With the bad lighting.
With the bad lighting, exactly.
Would you read to us Wild Gratitude?
Sure, that would be my pleasure. This is a poem in which my cat Zoe achieved literary immortality and fame by being associated with a famous cat out of literature, and that's Christopher Smart's cat, Jeffrey. Christopher Smart is a wonderful 18th century poet who spent a lot of his adult life in a mental hospital. And when he was there, he wrote a poem called Jubilate Agno. And as part of that poem, he began praising things in daily life extravagantly. And my poem quotes a few of those. He praises the postmaster general and all conveyancers of letters. He calls Jeffrey, his cat, the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him. He calls the mouse a creature of great personal valor. One of the things that struck me in Smart's poem is that for him, daily life became such a magical and wonderful thing. The most ordinary things were quite fantastic for him because he was so cut off from them. And I really related to that. So this is it, Wild Gratitude. Tonight when I knelt down next to our cat, Zoe, and put my fingers into her clean cat's mouth and rubbed her swollen belly that will never know kittens and watched her wriggle onto her side, pawing the air, and listened to her solemn little squeals of delight, I was thinking about the poet Christopher Smart, who wanted to kneel down and pray without ceasing in every one of the splintered London streets and was locked away in the madhouse at St. Luke's with a sad religious mania and his wild gratitude and his grave prayers for the other lunatics and his great love for his speckled cat, Jeffrey. All day today, August 13th, 1983, I remembered how Christopher Smart blessed this same day in August, 1759, for its calm bravery and ordinary good conscience. This was the day that he blessed the Postmaster General and all conveyancers of letters for their warm humanity, and the gardeners for their private benevolence and intricate knowledge of the language of flowers, and the milkmen for their universal human kindness. This morning I understood that he loved to hear, as I have heard, the soft clink of milk bottles on the rickety stairs in the early morning, and how terrible it must have seemed when even this small pleasure was denied him. But it wasn't until tonight when I knelt down and slipped my hand into Zoe's waggling mouth that I remembered how he'd called Jeffrey, the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him, and for the first time understood what it meant. Because it wasn't until I saw my own cat whine and roll over on her fluffy back that I realized how gratefully he had watched Jeffrey fetch and carry his wooden cork across the grass in the wet garden, patiently jumping over a high stick, calmly sharpening his claws on the woodpile, rubbing his nose against the nose of another cat, stretching, or slowly stalking his traditional enemy, the mouse, a rodent, a creature of great personal valor, and then dallying so much that his enemy escaped. And only then did I understand it is Jeffrey, and every creature like him, who can teach us how to praise, purring in their own language, wreathing themselves in the living fire.
Lovely.
Thanks.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Edward Hirsch, and he just read from his book of poetry called Wild Gratitude. And he has another book of poetry called For the Sleepwalkers. Both are published by Knopf, and he teaches creative writing at the University of Houston and was the 1986 winner of the National Book Critics Circle Award for poetry. One of the things you say is that the goal of poetry is to disturb and console.
I really believe that, and that's that Emily Dickinson once said that a great poem takes the top of your head off. I don't think poems are just there to make us feel good. I think they're there to make us aware of the complexities of human feeling. And that means to disturb us, to shake us up if we're not shaken up already, to make us live in a deeper way. And consoling because we can understand it and that it can be articulated in language. I don't think I'd want poetry that simply consoled us without enlarging our sense of the world or deepening our sense of the world. And I don't think I want a poetry that just disturbed us without giving us something to live by as well. So for me, those two parts are it's really a kind of quirky aesthetic, and I don't think all poets would own up to it. I don't mean to be speaking for my genre.
Right.
But for me, that's really part of what you're up to about, that it's both disturbing experiences that you're writing about because you're writing under the surface. And sometimes you're talking about things that either you don't want talked about or people around you don't want talked about or Americans don't want talked about. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of glossing over in our consciousness. And one of our job specifications as a poet is to get past the surface and to write about things that do get glossed over, to keep them from being glossed over. And that means a hard look at the worst. And that's disturbing. And yet, that doesn't mean that, we don't have words to live by as well. And that's the consolation.
So, do you think of yourself as a more passionate man than other people?
I wouldn't say that I'm more passionate than other people, but I would say that I really care about articulating that passion and speaking first for yourself and then hopefully for some other people as well, and that you may have a better gift at finding those feelings and articulating them through language. So I wouldn't put it comparatively, but I would say that for me, as a poet and as a person, emotion is a fundamental and primary value.
Have you always been that way?
Been that way, and I think that one of the reasons I found poetry was it seemed to me a place to put an excess of emotion. And one of the reasons I started writing poetry was that, maybe I wasn't suffering any more adolescent turmoils than any other teenager was suffering, but I felt them nonetheless. And I really didn't have a place to put my feelings. I didn't really understand what I was feeling. I certainly couldn't talk about what I was feeling to my jock friends. And I began to write poetry. And what seemed extraordinary to me, although I couldn't have articulated it at the time, was you took these feelings, which were potentially antisocial, and you turned them into something. Rutke talks about, despite the dark and dreck, the muck and mire of these poems, I want to be one of the happy poets. I don't think the poetry is just the expression of your emotions. I think it's the making of something. It's the making of a work of art. But I think it begins with that desperate need to get rid of your feelings and to find a place to put them. And it seemed to me a wonderful place, and I still believe in it. And so I think that you really write to help understand your life. And for me, that's an emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
Other poets are more cerebral. But I think there's certainly one tradition since Romantic poetry of poets who want to speak with what Keats calls the true voice of feeling.
We have about time for one more poem, and you did say we would never get through all the poems that we had lined up for this afternoon, but I'd like you to choose one that you would like to do.
Thanks. Well, I'd like to close with a poem called Dawn Walk. If thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure
to
talk
to you. Oh, it's been wonderful. Wonderful talking with you, too.
Dawn Walk. Some nights when you're asleep, deep under the covers, far away, slowly curling yourself back into a childhood no one living will ever remember, now that your parents touch hands under the ground, as they always did upstairs in the master bedroom, only more distant now, deaf to the nightmares, the small cries that no longer startle you awake, but still terrify me, so that I do get up some nights, restless and anxious to walk through the first trembling blue light of dawn in a calm snowfall. It's soothing to see the houses asleep in their own large bodies, the dreamless fences, the courtyards unscarred by human footprints, the huge clock folding its hands in the forehead of the skyscraper looming downtown. In the park, the benches are layered in white. The statue out of history is an outline of blue snow. Cars, too, are rimmed and motionless under a thin blanket smoothed down by the smooth maternal palm of the wind. So thanks to the blue morning, to the blue spirit of winter, to the soothing blue gift of powdered snow. And soon a few scattered lights come on in the houses. A motor coughs and starts up in the distance. Smoke raises its arms over the chimneys. Soon the trees suck in the darkness and breathe out the light, while black drapes open in silence. And as I turn home, where I know you are already awake, wandering slowly through the house, searching for me, I can suddenly hear my own footsteps crunching the simple, astonishing news that we are here. Yes, we are still here.
That's Edward Hirsch reading Dawn Walk from his book Wild Gratitude. Hirsch's other book is For the Sleepwalkers. Both are published by Knopf. As the winner of this year's Prix de Rome, Hirsch is leaving this week to spend next year in Italy. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.